We're excited to share this week the launch of our new Doctors of Running page at Running Warehouse. Ever want to tackle trails like David, crush hills like Matt, survive the cold like Nathan, or race like Andrea? Now's your chance. Head over to Running Warehouse to find all of our team's favorite apparel, nutrition, and more. Visit the link in our description to see the page today and make sure to check out Running Warehouse for all your running needs.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Doctors of Running podcast, where we, a group of doctors of physical therapy, discuss the art and science of running and the stuff that we put on our feet. Today at the roundtable, I have Dr. Matthew Klein with me, and I'll be hosting and basically interviewing him today. I'm Nathan Brown, and we get to take some time to discuss two studies that Matt has just submitted for publication. So we are going to give an update on his dissertation work, which pertains to master's runners and Achilles tendinopathy. So it's a very pertinent topic to in our way of understanding how we change as runners as we age. So we are going to ask our subjective in a second, but before I do that, if you want to be in the running to win another $100 gift card from Running Warehouse, thank you to them for providing these to kind of connect with y'all in this way. If you want to be entered to win a gift card for that, after you leave please, if you can, please go and leave a review of this podcast wherever you listen to it. Subscribe on YouTube. And then on the video that releases for this podcast, which drops on Sundays, you can just comment and answer the subjective, and that will enter you to win the $100 gift card from Running Warehouse. So, subjective for the day, as it relates to the research we're talking about, is when you think about where you're at as a runner now, whether you are a teenager or you're in your 20s, 30s, 40s, even if you're in your 50s, 60s, 70s, what are your long-term running goals? When you think 20 years down the road, what do you hope to be doing in your 60s, 70s, 80s as a runner? Or if you're only, 15, what do you hope to be doing at 35 as a runner? So think about your future self and where you hope to be, and tell us what are some long-term goals that you've had for yourself. So Matt, when you think about that, what are some of your goals?
I think this one's been there for a while, and maybe this kind of influenced some of my dissertation work, but I just want to be a good master's runner. I was very lucky to get to do some competition in my 20s and so, both in the NCAA D3, and then got to do some fun stuff like compete in some decent sized marathons and things like that. But what has really interested in me is going and getting really competitive on even a regional or national level as a master's runner. So it's really training hard, not really worried about what's happening right at this minute, but thinking, how do I keep building for the long term? And so I know this is actually part of getting into my stuff. People argue, oh, being a master starts at 35. I don't think so. Things change, but my definition is start getting, 40, 45, 50 and above, looking at how do you optimize our functions starting then, but at that point, but starting now. So yes, being a competitive master's runner is really my big goal.
You want to be nationally competitive as a master's runner. I love it.
I don't know if it's possible, but I that's what I really want to do.
That's great. Mine are a little less ambitious. I just want to be able to, when I think about myself running now compared to when I'm running in 20 years, I actually hope that I'm a stronger runner then than I am now. And I think the way that I would define that is I'm just having years of healthy running where I don't have to take time off due to these types of injuries I had last year. So I think your work and all the other stuff looking into musculoskeletal changes as we age and what sort of things we need to do to keep some of those at bay or whatever, that's what I'm interested in, because I just want to be able to go run a 50K. I want to be kind of an ultra person in my dreams, as kind of a 40s, 50s year old. I want to go and just enjoy, not a fast one, just go out and be able to do a 50 miler. Just sounds super fun in a weird kind of way. So that's where I want to be, is just healthy and robust. I just want a robust musculoskeletal system so that I can just go and run whatever I want to run. And even if it's slower, that's not really my aim. It's just durability is what I want.
You know what we should do is, remember when Regina ran the 100K and we all came out, you came out, we had a blast. For those of you who don't, Regina ran my wife ran the US 100K championships. What is that? Is it almost 2 years ago?
Oh, three now? Even, maybe.
Yeah. So Nathan and I got to see each other for the first time in person in a long time. So we were cheering on Regina. She's running the 100K on 10K loops, and Nathan and I just kept running together. We were shooting content. So it'd be so fun if we got you run the 100K.
Yeah.
Not that longer, much longer. And the whole team is there to support you. That would be really, really
fun. That would be super cool. Yeah.
Now I'm putting that in your head going, hey, we're going to do that as a team support you to do that.
That's my 20-year goal. I have a friend running it. It's coming up in a couple weeks from when we're recording this. Is. He's going to be running it this year. So I'm excited for him. Cool. Well, let's start talking about your dissertation research. First, I just want you to give a brief, kind of some brief context for what is the stage of your research and where is it in cyberspace? Where's your research at?
Yeah. So I am still in my PhD. So I'm finishing up my dissertation. So I've written the first, like basically all the chapters except the final one. And the final one is essentially a conclusion and discussion about what everything that I've seen and found. The origin behind this is there was a lot of different versions of what I thought I wanted to do. And then I kind of came upon this because I found that there was a gap in the literature regarding Masters runners, especially regarding Achilles tendinopathy. Because the more research I was doing, I was going, all right, so what do I want to do? I really like working with older runners. I like seeing how the body changes with age and how do we optimize that? Because people tend to think that that's like, as you get older, it's an end instead of the way that kind of some of the – what we're starting to realize is, no, it's just a new opportunity. You just have to be aware of some of the changes you need to make, but you can still optimize things on incredible levels. Don't – it's not the end. It's a new beginning, if anything, just realizing you have a changing body. So the problem is there's not a lot of research on this. There's some stuff going, okay, here's the most common injuries. And we knew that I saw the literature saying that injuries change as we get older. When you're younger, you get a lot of stuff surrounding the knee, like patellar tendinopathy, Achilles tendon, IT band stuff. Like there's a kind of a top couple injuries, and it's really focused kind of more like around the knee joint and that kind of stuff. But as we get older, it switches. And Achilles tendinopathy was the number one thing, followed by hamstring issues and calf issues. And there was no explanation in the research. I'm like, that's interesting. Those are really important for speed, for function. And I saw a correlation between, like, I'm treating all these Masters runners. It's like Achilles, calf, hamstring, over and over. And I'm like, I'm treating individuals, but why? What's happening? What's going on? So that was the push to start this. And so where this is now in terms of like cyberspace stuff like that, the systematic review idea, which was my lit review, kind of my semi-introduction chapter, is published out there. It is published in the Journal of Sports Biomechanics. So if you would like that, there is a paywall because I didn't want to spend – for those of you who don't know, like behind the curtain, if you want to make your stuff open access, you have to pay like thousands of dollars. And I'm like, no, just email me and I'll give it to you for free. Just yes. FYI, like I get charged enough. So I have the PDF. I'll just give it to you. So that is published and that's public domain right now. The second part, that was kind of my intro to go, what's happening in younger athletes compared to Masters runners. And what I found is there wasn't actually that much different than kind of what we suspected. Like the knee joint really didn't change as we got older. It's like, you know, biomechanics weren't changing. It was like fairly similar. What was changing was something around the ankle and the hip, that there was changes in like plantar flexion kind of moments and powers, and things were getting different. Something was happening at the ankle, and there was also some stuff happening at the hip where stride length was changing, like it was starting to shorten, but for some reason people were actually extending their hip more. And I was like, that doesn't make any sense. Like what's going – how is the knee not changing at that? So it was good information, but I was like, I don't know what this means. So why don't we actually go get – healthy Masters runners and those with Achilles tendinopathy to see like what are the actual changes between those are healthy and those are not. I thought that'd be the best way to see what kind of deficits are showing up. Now, be aware, I'm going to say this a couple times, this is observational research. You cannot make conclusions like I can go do this intervention now. This is just the beginning of a lifetime of looking into this. So the study was looking at Masters runners over 50 because I really wanted to make sure we're getting into the time point where we were truly seeing changes. And then Masters runners who were healthy and those who had Achilles tendinopathy, and I was having them run, do a single leg hop because I wanted to look at power. And then I also put them on what's called an isokinetic dynamometer, which is the gold standard to test strength. And I was looking at the strength, biomechanics of the hip and the ankle, specifically the hip extensors and the ankle plantar flexors or calves throughout all this stuff. And so those, I've separated those into two studies. I have a ton more data that I, after PhD, I'm going to hopefully put some stuff together and have some more answers. But the two major studies was running versus the strength testing, and then the single leg hopping. Because I was going, what do running mechanics look like, and does that relate to their strength? And then single leg hopping, because I want to know, I suspect that power is playing a really big thing. And power is how quickly can you produce force? I was going, all right, I feel like there's going to be something there. So those are two studies. They are both submitted to the Journal of Sports Biomechanics. One is with the editor and one's waiting the super
queue.
Long process in the queue. Yeah. So both
cool.
submitted though.
Well, congrats. I know that's a big
Thanks.
Process
yeah.
to just get things ready. And you know, for those who have gone through a dissertation process, you have experienced all of the iterations you get to go through. You get a lot of helpful and critical feedback on your stuff.
Yeah.
Like it's one of those things where you put your heart and soul into like really trying to curate and understand
yeah.
and interpret data. And then you get somebody who, whether it feels like it or not, lovingly says to you, this sucks, do it different.
Yeah.
And then you have
garbage.
To like say,
yeah.
okay, this isn't me. This was me trying something, but my identity's not wrapped up in that. So let's go back and
it's
try
not
to,
supposed to be.
It's not supposed
it's
to be.
It's not supposed to be, but it becomes because you spent thousands, hundreds of thousands of hours trying to run. This is it. This is the go. Nope, we're going to do another revision. This
yeah.
is version 20 of this. Yeah.
yeah. So
yeah.
Again, just all that to say,
Thanks.
Congrats
yeah.
on getting there. And now
yeah.
I think what would be really interesting for us to do is to talk about those two different research questions you
yeah.
asked. And so if
yeah.
you could actually before this, I just thought of this. So this
yeah.
is not a sponsor, by the way. But this shell, it's from Path Projects. It's the Graves PX shell. It's awesome. It's like a water resistant one. And I've gotten a number of runs in. It's been rainy around here. Well, we got like 6 inches. We were supposed to get 6 inches of snow, but it was much less than that. But it was a big snowy weekend anyway. But we've gotten a lot of rain too. This thing's dope. So good. Highly recommend. Again, not a sponsor. There's your little brain break. Now going back in, because we're going to go deep into research and statistics
yeah.
and all this stuff. So
yeah. Yeah.
can you bring us into that first study on running and the correlation between running and strength measures? And maybe just talk a little bit about what your research question was and then kind of a little bit more about the methods. What did you measure? What
yeah.
equipment
yeah.
gave you that data, that kind of thing?
Yeah. And let me be careful because I made that mistake. I didn't necessarily correlate the running and the strength stuff. I mean, I did actually, but it's not part of the public. There's a ton of stuff that I calculated that I'll share
yeah.
that didn't end up getting in there because like it was not significant enough to actually be worth talking about.
On.
At least,
mm-hmm.
yeah, that's for those who don't know a lot of the research. There's tons of stuff out there that's not significant. They just don't tell you because. Unfortunately, a lot of times some of the feedback you get from journals and then your mentors learn this is like, well, if it's not significant, like try not to report it. And it's like, oh, well, I feel like that's still important, but that's off topic. So I did actually correlate it, which is a different story. It was just looking at the strength measures and submaximal running mechanics. And I want to clarify that just going, you know, these two groups have this, their shared similarity is that they both run. It would make sense to look at running. And my hypothesis was, I suspect that there's going to be some differences in how much dorsiflexion they have, how much hip extension they have while running. And I expect to see different biomechanics. Like I expect to see different moments, which are like forces essentially that are generated by muscles at the hip and the ankle. I'm expecting them to be less at the hip and more at the ankle. I'm expecting those with Achilles tendinopathy to have less hip extensor strength and less calf strength because I think that that's going to put more stress on the Achilles tendon. So those are my hypotheses about going, all right, I'm expecting basically see like less of everything up higher, especially when it comes to strength. But the one thing I'm expecting to see more of is increased moments or forces at the ankle because I think that's going to stress the Achilles more.
So just to reiterate and make sure I'm understanding what you did, what you did is you're really comparing these two groups in both
yeah.
of these two areas.
Observational.
You're
yes.
comparing the healthy and the Achilles tendinopathy group in their strength metrics, and you're also comparing them between each other with the running mechanics. And you thought
yes.
that you would see less strength output in the
yep.
Achilles tendinopathy group, and you also thought that you would see a difference in mechanics between the two groups, but you also thought that both groups would show increased workload at the ankle during running, or were you saying you thought you'd see that in the Achilles tendinopathy group?
Just in the Achilles tendinopathy group is what I thought. And again, how I did this is the running. I talked about how I measured its strength, which is pretty consistent. It's the gold standard for looking at strength is isokinetic dynamometers. Have you ever seen what's called a Biodex or Humac Norm, where you kind of sit on the thing and you got the lever that kind of get to push your limb back and forth? That's what I used. For the running biomechanics, we had a 3D motion capture system and force plates. So they would the runners would go across these force plates, and we'd also measure how they're moving, their max joint angles, and things like that.
Great. So tell us a little bit. Let's start on the strength side of things. How did those numbers shake out? What did you learn?
So what I learned was there was actually no difference in ankle plantar flexion strength or calf strength between the groups. It was exactly the same. Even across the board, like, look, there was very little variability. It was fairly consistent among groups. It really wasn't that different. The hip strength values were slightly less. It was still significant, so it was reportable, but it was less in the Achilles tendinopathy group. So they had less hip less hip extensor strength, but no differences in calf or plantar flexor strength.
Okay, and did that surprise you?
Yeah, it really did, because I would have assumed, and you know, it makes me think, is I tell my students all the time, don't assume there's weakness because there's pathology, and that was an incorrect assumption. I mean, that's what we do. It's scientific method, right? But there was not a difference in calf strength, which I was expecting there to be less, because there actually has been some literature that suggested that that calf strength can be weaker. But there is also alternative research that suggests there isn't actually weakness, and there's even a small little bit that says those with Achilles tendinopathy can actually sometimes have more calf strength. And so there's some variability there. So this group of master runners that I specifically looked at did not have any differences in calf strength. It was only the hip that was decreased.
Great. And that was for hip extensor strength.
Yeah.
Did you measure any other directions or any other muscle groups? Did you look at like knee flexion?
Yeah, so let me clarify. I did not look at hip flexion. I did not look at knee extension because those things had not been found to be different. I did look at, for the ankle and the hip, I looked at concentric and eccentric strength. And it was the hip extension, both concentric and eccentric strength were decreased. For ankle plantar flexion, both concentric and eccentric were not different.
Okay. So what's your why behind this? Like, why do you think you saw those findings that you saw? You know, why do you think that they maybe didn't have decreased strength in the calf? Kind of what do you take from that?
Yeah, you want to know the real, like, first answer that I have?
No idea.
It was like, I don't know, man. Like, I think by itself, it doesn't tell a full story. And this is the challenging part about research, and I learned this very quickly with doing this stuff. And you'll see kind of how there are some things that match, and there's some things that don't match at all, and I still have questions about that. But that's how you continue research. My further hypothesis has to be tested as I'm going, all right, so what my assumption is they don't – it's not obviously decreased strength at the calf, even though there may be some other biomechanical factors there. Clearly the issue is calf strength. They can still protect – they're still able to generate enough force to do it. But then that made me realize, and when I looked in the literature, is actually if you go look at the literature, calf strength is not a consistent method, not a consistent metric to really look at tendinopathies in the Achilles. It's actually when you get velocity involved in power where it actually becomes much more significant.
And we'll get to that in study two.
Yeah, we'll get that to that in a second. And I was like, that didn't make sense to me until I really looked at the data in the second study. So I'm like, okay. That's consistent with kind of what some of the stuff that I found later going, yes, power, more maximal efforts tend to be a little bit better at that.
Okay.
If you just look at all out strength metrics, it's like looking at quantity versus quality. The quantity isn't always different. How it's being generated is a little bit more of the story. And so that's what I started realizing.
Yeah.
The hip strength being different is interesting to me because, I mean, there is evidence that the less force you generate at like the hip, the more so that happens to the ankle and vice versa. However, it's like, well, you're generating, there's less going on at the hip, but the ankle's the same. And actually I do have data on the knee. The knee is also the same too. So it's like, wait.
Yeah. So to to dig into that for a second, you know, you have this concept where you have this decreased force production at the hip, you have similar force productions at the ankle, and then you also compared running mechanics, and you just kind of started to refer to at the hip, there was less going on in the Achilles group. Can you just go into that a little bit?
Yeah. So the biomechanics?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I guess so. Here's where it gets weird. The biomechanics really weren't any different.
Between the groups.
Yeah. Peak motions were not different. So peak stride, like hip extension, wasn't different. Ankle motions were not different. And I was looking primarily in the sagittal plane because recent evidence has suggested that some of the frontal plane stuff actually is not as consistent as we would have liked. Like one of the ideas was, yeah, you pronate more, there's more twisting of the Achilles. And there's actually been some evidence suggesting that actually may not be a thing. And so it was like, all right, the only consistent thing was we're seeing sagittal plane, you know, like front to back, it wasn't different. And the moments were also not different at the ankle or the hip. So it's like, wait, hip, like strength values are different, but the forces being generating during submaximal running, which is just running an easy pace, which may have been where the issue was, wasn't any different. So when you go up for a jog, the mechanics really, at least the quantitative mechanics, weren't that different.
Interesting.
And it's very interesting.
Did your study in terms of all of, I know you collected tons of different data. Did you look at duty cycle in this study, looking at like the amount of time on the ground versus time in the air?
No.
Okay.
So I have that information. I have yet to pull that out.
Okay.
And one of the reasons I did that is because a PhD does have some limitations. You have to be a little bit cautious with what you report on.
Yeah.
The easiest things to report on in a PhD is looking at like max values. So like isokinetic, like max strength, right?
Yeah.
Or peak joint ankles or peak moments. Some of the things like duty cycles, things like that, you have to be a little bit careful with because at the end of the day, you're trying to get this thing like finished.
Yeah, totally.
And your committee is going to, you know, tear you a new one if it's not. So that data is there. I have not looked at it or parsed it out yet.
Great. I have two questions for you, or one comment and a question. The comment is, the reason I asked about duty cycle was Malazzo just came out with another study that looks at injury rates in relation to duty cycle. So there's more stuff kind of coming out in that realm, which I think is interesting. The second thing, which is more of a question, is now it's escaping my brain. This is how my life works. Just forget things. That's okay.
I do that all the time right now.
It just goes away.
Being a parent and trying to do a second doctorate degree, which we're both doing, is just what happens.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tap out. Well, let's move forward then, because I can't think of it. Oh, this is what I was going to ask. Can you explain? You've used the word moment a lot. So you've talked about joint angles and max hip flexion and all these, or hip extension and these joint angles. Can you just explain what a moment is, just so that people understand who may not have like a PT degree?
Yeah, that's fine. So normally we talk about forces, like forces are usually in a single plane of motion, right? Like if I'm landing on the ground, like a vertical ground reaction force, it's like how much force is coming straight back up. When you're talking about joints don't really do that same thing. They're not, it's usually much more rotational. So a moment is looking at more kind of that rotational force. And there's internal moments, there's external things that create them inside and outside. And it just essentially means like a joint or almost like a more of a rotational force, so to speak.
Great.
And you can have like summations and stuff like that. And I'm going to be totally honest with you that it took me like multiple years to finally really understand what a moment is. And half the time I'm going, did I say that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It basically just means like kind of like joint or rotational force, essentially, but not quite torque.
Yeah.
It's different.
Yep. Great. Thank you. So let's move on to study number two then. So let's talk about, so you have this first one where you took these two groups and between them you compared their strength numbers, where you basically found that there was a slight decrease in hip extensor strength output or force production output, but everything at the ankle was defined. Then you looked at mechanics and everything between those two groups looked the same, whether they had Achilles tendinopathy or not. And then now you did this study number two. So bring us into the second study that you have in for publication.
And I will clarify that for those who are listening who actually participated in the study and you know how long it took to do each one of these, this was all done at once. So we did the running mechanics, did the hopping, and then did the isokinetic dynamometry. Be like, I'm a little sore the next day. I'm like, yeah, you just did like a 2-hour workout. So, you know.
Yeah.
So the second study was looking at single leg horizontal hop mechanics. And the reason I was looking at that is I knew from previous evidence that the single leg horizontal hop, meaning like you're not jumping straight up, you're jumping forward as far as you can. When you jump forward, much more of the propulsive force comes from the hip and the ankle. The knee does not contribute very much until you land. And so what I was seeing in my systematic review is it looked like more of the deficits and changes that happen as we get older was happening during the propulsive phase. And my theory was something's happening there that if I can piece out together that I think may be contributing to some of the risk factors for Achilles tendinopathy. So I chose a single leg horizontal hop, which is also a great measure of power, whereas like, you know, submaximal running mechanics, even isokinetic dynamometry, it's really hard to get accurate measures of power, how fast somebody can generate force out of that stuff. So I thought this would be a great test to use because it's very well validated, it's clinically relevant, and I thought, great, let's do this. So I had the master's runners stand on one force plate and hop as far as they could to another force plate and land, even though I wasn't actually looking at how they landed, that it just needed them to land safely, and was looking at how they propelled themselves off the plate.
In single leg, correct? You may have said
in
that.
Single leg,
in
yes.
Single leg, great.
Yeah, because that would be, I felt like, most relevant to running mechanics.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about what you found with it then.
Yeah, this was a little bit more consistent, where there was decreased power at both the hip and, I should say, positive power, meaning you're generating the force rather than negative or eccentric power is where you're landing and having to shock absorb really quick. So I was just looking at propulsion or positive power, but there was less hip positive power, hip extensor positive power, and ankle plantar flexion positive power in the Achilles tendinopathy group. I also still looked at those same moments, and there was decreased hip moments, but there was not decreased ankle moments.
What does that tell you?
So what's interesting there is that power, when we typically calculate that from a biomechanics standpoint, you actually use some of the moments to calculate. You use some of the forces, right? So it's force, but then it's force in relationship to velocity. So I thought, I was looking at that going, well, at the ankle, where this pathology is primarily happening, if the amount of force isn't different, the velocity has to be the thing that's different. Now, as I got called out for, I do have that data. I just have to pull it out correctly, but I have it because there's only so much you can report on a study. But that's – I highly suspect the how quickly things were – if I look at velocity, that might be different. But that's interesting. It was both at the ankle and the hip. So the single leg hop study was much more in line with what I thought was going to happen. It
right.
just took a more truly maximal power test to pull this out. And what I realized looking back at the first study is going, I should have had them like sprint across the plate. But unfortunately, it was not a treadmill based. If people have done this before, sometimes you can do like biomechanics on a treadmill. At APU, we just have the force plates in the ground. So I did like only a couple meters for them to run across. So sprinting at that level has not been found to be very accurate. So I was kind of limited with that.
Right.
So I suspect like I need to look at more maximal stuff. And I think this relates more because a lot of them, not all, but a lot of the masters that I'm working with, they're not running at submaximal efforts all the time. But if you do that, maybe you don't get as injured. All of these, the people that I tested, regardless of their ability, were all people that still competed. And they were still people that, you know, they go run easy one day and then they might have a workout. Or if it's not structured, they go run fast one day for them and then run ease another day and kind of gets around. So it's like, well, if the submaximal running mechanics aren't different, and I have to be very careful with what I'm about to say because I didn't actually test maximal running mechanics, and there is no evidence that has ever linked hopping to running,
right?
Which is another study I might be working on. please no one steal that. I have to be careful. Is going my suspicion is that during normal submaximal efforts, you're not probably going to see as much stuff, but when you try to run faster or when you try to generate more maximal efforts, not necessarily running because we don't know that for sure, there's going to be differences, and that may potentially put the tendon more at risk because I suspect to really use the calf, you have to be able to absorb – like so the calf will help the tendon optimally absorb energy, but then to release it, you actually have to move that thing fast enough to actually efficiently release it. And if you're not moving fast enough, I think that energy doesn't have anywhere to go, and you're going to end up working harder to push forwards. And that puts more stress to the tendon. At least that's my theory that I'm working on.
Yeah, I think that's super interesting. And, you know, I think you've already laid out the limitations of this sort of research.
But observational.
Can you just repeat that one more time in terms of what sort of conclusions can we draw from this, from the studies itself? I think I have some more like practical questions for you based on how you conceptualize this, but this that lies outside of the purview of the study itself. So can you just repeat kind of what are your conclusions with both of these studies?
This is good practice for my dissertation defense.
There we go.
So the first study, the conclusions were that there are hip strength, maximal strength deficits at the hip, but not at the ankle, and that when running at submaximal paces, there's no difference between those who do and do not have Achilles tendon problems. So you cannot tell differences across the board looking at running mechanics in those who do and don't have this. The second study suggested that you can better visualize the deficits in those who have Achilles tendinopathy if you use a single leg hop test, a maximal test. And what you might find in this group is that there is decreased power at both the hip and the ankle, and there's decreased forces at the hip. What that necessarily means, we can postulate, but because this is an observational research, meaning we're just watching and taking in data, we're not doing an intervention, I cannot make a conclusion about what treatments need to be done. I cannot make any conclusion about, is this like, you know, chicken or the egg kind
That's
of thing. Like,
be my next
question. Did this come first, right? Or did the I don't know that. And so one of the big questions remains is, are these changes that happened after the pathology or did they contribute before? We don't know. So we just know that this seems to be present at this time point.
And that is something that I think clinically, when I'm working with people and PTs that are working with people, inevitably in a conversation with a patient that you're working with or a client, they're going to ask, so why did this happen? And I think that sometimes we can take these studies and try to say one way or another, but reality is we really don't know, again, just to tease it out again and just to make it explicit again, we don't know whether the power production through that forward hop test was due to the existence of their Achilles tendinopathy or if it was they had that power deficit and therefore it led to the tendinopathy. We don't know. Right. And that's right. Usually the case
it
when
can
it
go
comes.
Either way.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's the case when we have people in with us because we don't have the data before their injury. And so I guess my next question for you now starts to move away from the studies themselves and more how you conceptualize either whether you're a runner yourself or if you're a PT who works with runners and you're trying to tease some of this stuff out. I think some of the questions I have in my head, some of them revolve around like, how would you, in a clinic that doesn't have a force plate, measure power? And the other one is, what sort of things are worth either doing or measuring as you age to kind of work on this power side of things?
Yeah. So my answer for the first one about what clinically relevant tests do you think we can use? One of them is I don't know at this point. I mean, it's good still to do, but I wouldn't put as much emphasis on the running motion analysis, seeing going, okay, that didn't seem the thing that really generated the biggest difference. Some people might have some things that contribute, and that's totally fine. But a lot of the things that I would be looking at in this population, the reason why I picked this was as you get older, one of the things we lose most significantly unless you work on it is power. You lose muscle mass. You actually lose more strength relative to the amount of muscle mass you lose, and you lose more power relative to your strength. So this is something very important no matter what sport or activity, or even if you're not athletic, what you're doing as an aging individual, you lose power more than anything. And the problem with that is that is most predictive of function. Like the biggest preventative factor for falls is actually how much power you have because you can react quickly, right? So it's also like in terms of getting a lot of our activities of daily living, we don't talk about, they require power, getting upstairs, getting out of a seat. Like to do that optimally takes not just how much strength you have, but can you generate it quickly to do these things? So I honestly think that some of this very simple like single limb power test, like the single leg hop test, is a great test to do. Put some tape down. Go, hey, how far can you hop on one leg versus the other? Or like, how far can you hop? Does it even look qualitatively good. Because if you want to run and you run fast, running is a series of single leg hops, essentially. And you're having to generate force much faster than you were doing it while running or while walking. So you do need a level of power to do these activities. So I think some of the clinically relevant tests, like the physical performance test, so the single leg horizontal hop test, if that's not safe enough, doing some of the double limb jumps or things like that, which you just need a piece of tape and a tape measure to measure, are really good tests that I think are worth looking at.
Did you see in your lit review any, when you were choosing your tests that you were going to do, are there any correlation studies between force plate power output and distance in that horizontal hop test?
That's a great question. I don't think anybody has done that. Great study.
Let's do that. If it does, then dang, then you don't have to buy a force plate and you can just be like, how far can you do this? And then we could correlate, you know, kind of like how there's studies for strength that have worked to understand what's the relationship between a 3 rep max knee extension and an isokinetic knee extension test, just to know, like, and usually, so not that people care about this, but like a 3 rep max test is going to overestimate your limb symmetry as compared to an isokinetic test. So therefore, clinically, as a clinician, I make sure that instead of returning to sport at 90% quad strength, I return to sport at 95% quad strength if I'm using a 3 rep max knee extension. So in the same way, I think that would be an interesting thing to learn.
That's
is like,
idea.
Do we have, can we get some data to correlate what, you know, and we just get like hundreds of people to do this and see if we get the same or different. That'd be a helpful clinical study. If it showed that it was correlated. If it's not, then we know it's not. And then we can have more accurate interpretation of our findings, but cool.
We got to put that on the docket.
Yeah, let's put it on the docket. Yeah. And then when it comes to what you think as a runner who is, I mean, we're both in our mid-30s. What sort of things do you think are valuable to work on? And again, this is outside of the purview of the conclusions of your study. But with everything that you know, what do you think is smart to do?
I think the number one thing that I've seen, and I talked about this on the previous podcast, is you're going to do plenty of running, but really working on high level strength training. And I'm not saying go do this for like 10 hours a day. I'm saying even for a few minutes, like once or twice a week, working on kind of more intense strength training is really important. I talked about the same thing with Rich Willey about, like, you know, building bone density, right? And you're seeing the same thing as you age, that we lose strength. That's something really important to continue to work on, because by itself, running is not a great way to improve strength. It will definitely improve your aerobic capacities. There's some tissues like changes that will occur, but if you want to get better at, if you want to get stronger, you really need to do strength training. Yeah. And it doesn't mean you need to be to do 50 hours of it a day. It's just like even a couple minutes warming up, doing some very simple stuff, a deadlift, a squat, something that's like heavy, getting close to your max, and a couple reps of those is a really great way of doing strength stuff. And I think the same can be said with tendinopathies, because they do tend to become a little bit more common as we get older. I think working on, like, you know, heavy, slow resistance training is really, really important for some of the major tendons of lower extremity, be it hamstring, quad, and certainly Achilles. But the thing I would add that I learned is you also got to be working on power. Like, it's not just how much strength you can produce or force you can produce, it's how the quality of it. And anecdotally, qualitatively, a lot of the masters runners I work with are going, I haven't hopped since I was in high school.
Yeah.
And I'm like, so there was a good, I gave them at least one test trials, but how many trials it took them to actually complete it varied greatly until we could actually get them to truly take off and stick a maximal test. And that took some time for them to figure out.
Yeah.
So again, you're thinking as you get older, hey, my speed's decreasing. Like, all this stuff's decreasing. I'm having this. I think, again, same thing as the strength training. Doing some careful, less is more with this, because this, unlike strength training, power training is one of the things, like, you can get away with that once a week, because you don't realize how, like, jumping around can actually make you pretty sore. And it's high benefit, but it's also high risk.
Yep.
So it's, you know, less is more. But I think doing some hopping and single leg stuff, single leg hopping would be really beneficial for people who are aging to work on. And even with for the non-runners I've worked with, I have lots of I love the geriatric population. I have lots of people in their late 70s and 80s who I'm like, we're going to do a box jump and it might be this tall, but we're going to still work on that. And you get people who start crying going, I haven't like jumped like this. And I don't know how in like 80 years. And it's like, they actually
crying because they're terrified or crying because they're pumped that they just did it.
They're pumped. Yeah. Yeah. The second we're like pumped and they're like, wow, I can't believe I did this. So what I'm seeing overarching beyond what I'm looking at is that there is a way to age optimally. And you don't have to do a crazy diet or crazy workout technique. You just need to have some basic things that you need to maintain that we typically don't do as we age. Like you work on all kinds of jumping and all kinds of fun stuff as a kid that you don't do as an adult. And it would be very helpful, even in small dosages, to continue to do that, recognizing that that is very important for your health, no matter what age you are.
Yeah.
And so what I hope from a career standpoint is kind of try to make that a little bit more known to go, there are changes that are happening. Now the question is, no matter what or who you are, how do you help age well? And yeah. So that's kind of my long pie in the sky version of what I'd like to do is that's my clinical my thought of what you can work on.
I think what could be fun is creating a library of a kind of progression of those two areas to like maximize your or to age well with our musculoskeletal systems and create that as like an opportunity for people to like, I don't know, like get in on learning how to do that smart in a, you know, 16-week progression. We should put that on our dream list for DOR to create something like that and kind of operationalize some of this stuff that you're learning. And I think that could be super fun to think
through. Because there's been great evidence on those two things in terms of like strength training, reducing injuries, power training, improving performance. Like, you know, imagine if 90% of runners just that was just like, because most people will do some kind of random stretching routine before they run. Like, imagine if they just had a very brief thing they did after their run with that. Like, injuries would decrease. You know, I know it's odd for two people to be two physical therapists to go, how do we decrease the number of people that have to come see us? Yeah. But we're very lucky to be in a preventative profession where we want you to be healthy. We want you to not need us because that's part of living well and prevention. So yeah, that'd be really cool.
Absolutely. In so we have a pro bono clinic on campus. And one of the things that I have the privilege of doing with our students is we work with the cross country and track team and ROTC, and we bring them through a full running evaluation. So we do 3D analysis of their gait, and then we do a full strength assessment using handheld dynamometry, and then we do a functional movement assessment, and we do a mobility assessment. So we look at hip, knee, ankle strength, hip, knee, ankle mobility, running mechanics, and then we have some functional movements. One of our functional movements is a single leg forward hop or the horizontal hop. The second, one of the other ones is a drop jump off of a box. And it's amazing that even college runners have a really hard time hopping. They run a lot, but they don't have that kind of like power, even though they're very, very fast. And you know, these are, you know, it's a D3 school, but these guys and gals are running very quickly. And jumping's hard. Jumping's really hard for them. So I think it's just an interesting observationally and it makes me glad that we're testing some of those things. And we'll have to keep chatting about how to best learn from all of the stuff that we're doing in that lab as well, because I think that there's a lot to be discovered. So yeah, what other thoughts have you had in this process of learning and kind of final wrap-up thoughts?
Yeah, I think one of the things I've learned is to not think linearly, if that makes sense, because a lot of the previous data on this stuff is like, oh, you know, you have like the joint moments again, like, right? Like there's a certain amount that goes in the low extremity. If they decrease somewhere, they're supposed to increase somewhere else. And I actually didn't see that. I saw them because, as I mentioned, even though I didn't include the knee in the study, the knees weren't any different.
Right.
They were the same too. They had the same joint moments, the same all that. So I'm like, even during the hop, the power and moments weren't any different. And I was like, okay, so you're decreasing at the hip and the ankle. where's that stuff going?
Yeah.
The thing is that I realized is I need to go back and I can probably figure this out, but I didn't actually measure how far they hopped.
Yeah.
But I think you can actually get that data.
Right.
So that would be a nice follow-up to do, because that's totally typically what you actually do with the single leg hop test.
Yeah, but you were getting the – but that's not what you were looking at. Biomechanics. So that's, that's the thing.
Biomechanical factors.
Yes.
So what I realized – there's a lot of different ways to look at this, and what you need to remember is you can't look linearly. Sometimes you have to look at multiple planes of information to think about this. It's like, okay, well, strength isn't different. The moments are different. What if we look at the quality of those measures? And if I've learned anything is I think – you know, you have to go down a path. And so we teach our students, like, don't jump to the last, like, minute thing first. Clear out the big stuff, right? How do they move? What's their basic level of strength? If that's clear, then you can start going to what are the quality of those movements, right? So movement coordination. What's the quality of how you generate that force? How quickly you're doing it? How consistently you're doing it? And I think there's a lot of good stuff in that quality area that we're just beginning to learn that I'm super curious about, especially as – we age going, hey, like, how's that quality change? Because if we know how it changes, we have a better idea of how do we start designing interventions to see can we address those and can we start potentially slowing down some of those performance related changes that we see and start aging more optimally. And so it's some cool stuff, but honestly, way more questions than answers, which is exactly what this is supposed to do.
Perfect.
So
here's my final question for you for the night. Has, just because this is the Doctors Running Podcast, has any of this research and the study that you've been working on, has that changed how you consider shoe choice for people as we age?
Yeah, it actually did. And there was actually a study done not too long ago on looking at masters runners and like the effect of super shoes. And I don't think they found that massive of a difference, but what made me think about this is knowing, okay, masters runners are typically losing power, and there's a group, obviously, with Achilles tendinopathy, they're losing a greater amount. And it made me wonder about the use of super shoes in this population, because I know many – this is anecdotal – many, many people who are training full-time in these shoes as masters runners, like, that, I feel great. I'm going to use this all the time. Some of them are healthy. Some of them are not. And the great thing about these shoes – is that, yes, they save your legs, right? They feel fun all the time. One of the challenges, though, is if there's an increased risk of pathology in this population, which I'm going to argue maybe there's a biomechanical reason and maybe there's not. Maybe that's a secondary thing that's not related to biomechanics. And if there's not, you are taking away one of the things that actually helps the tendon get stronger. There's some early suggestion that some of these shoes decrease load through the tendons, but you need that load to help keep remodeling and keep it strong. So I would still highly suggest that even if you love these shoes, these are probably not something you should train in all the time, because you may or may not be putting yourself at risk for the tendons not being remodeled and loaded the way you need. I don't have any evidence behind that. That's purely, you know, me putting things together and asking questions and going, huh.
But I wonder
if maybe using these things all the time isn't the greatest idea. I mean, we've already talked about this in the younger population. I think with older individuals, the same thing might occur, as you might have to deal with, you know, you got to be smart with your training, right? So, yeah, that was what made me think about that and ask, like, okay, so I don't think the shoes are the priority in terms of treating this, but I think still being a little cautious with your shoe choice might be helpful. Although if you're somebody that maybe you've got this chronically, maybe a rockered shoe would be really good. Maybe that you need to decrease stress there, but you also have to realize that stress is what helps things remodel. And so you being strategic with your choice is good, and maybe not trying to go, oh, I can only do that. I'm only running in this shoe. It's like, you know, where extremes don't generally work.
Right.
It's much more kind of – there's a lot of minutia to it, understanding how and when to use things rather than yes or no. So that's kind of my air bubble thoughts on like what do I think shoe-wise.
Fantastic.
Ironically, one of the most common questions is talking about like – you're supposed to be like it would take about 2 hours and we'd be talking about shoes half the time. Go, oh, I like Doctors Running. Like, what do you think of this? Like, oh, this is – I'm like, it's a great question. I don't know. Like, I'm not looking at that. So,
yeah.
But we can talk about it.
Yep. Absolutely. Yep. Well, Matt, thanks again for sharing all of this and congrats on the progress you've been making. It's a lot of work that you've put into it and excited to hear. I mean, I'm excited that you're now at this point where you can go towards defense and you can get done with the PhD. And so congratulations there. We're all at DOR super proud of you and your progress. It's just been really fun to be with you on the journey and hoping the best for kind of whatever's next. And now you have some freedom in what you get to start looking at. You get to just keep trying the journey. So thanks for kind of laying your, it's kind of like laying your heart out there when you're talking. It's, you know, we just talked about research for 50 minutes, but really it's like Matt's heart because he's put so much time into it. So be nice to Matt. Okay.
This has broken my heart multiple times. Be nice.
No,
still learning.
Appreciate you sharing and, really excited to see what you do next. If you want to keep following what we're doing at Doctors of Running, you can always check out our work at doctorsofrunning.com. You can also follow us on any of the social media platforms at Doctors of Running, and you can see all of the different types of shoe reviews that we put out, but also research reviews and things like that. So thanks for following up on us, with all of this. If you want to win the gift card, leave a review, head over to YouTube on Sunday and on when this releases on YouTube, if you're listening on the audio, and answer the subjective question, and we'll talk to y'all soon.